Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk, and we are back to impeachment hearings today. The inquiry moved to the House Judiciary Committee, where lawmakers questioned legal experts about what constitutes an impeachable offense and whether President Trump committed one. Three of the experts were brought by Democrats and the other one by Republicans. And here with me to break down the legal arguments that the witnesses made and what lawmakers had to say as well, our politics writer, Claire Malone. How's it going, Claire?
Hey, Galen.
And also with us is senior writer and legal reporter Amelia Thompson DeVoe. How's it going, Amelia?
I'm good, thanks.
Another hearing on the books. And I'll also note that we just received the latest results from a panel poll that we're conducting with Ipsos about public opinion on impeachment. So later in the episode, I'm going to speak with our quantitative editor and the president of Ipsos. But let's get to the hearings from today. So Amelia, there were, of course, three Democratic witnesses and then one Republican brought witness, and they had different views of the law accordingly. But to start with the witnesses that were brought by Democrats, what was their argument in terms of whether this constitutes an impeachable offense?
Well, they were pretty clear that they thought Trump's behavior did fit into the category of an impeachable offense. And they made that argument basically by sort of walking through their understanding of what the founders meant an impeachable offense to be. And especially, you know, we heard a lot about this idea that an impeachable offense doesn't have to be a criminal offense. A president can engage in conduct that is impeachable because it endangers the country in some way, or it sort of poses a threat that would prevent him from continuing to serve as president in the way we want, and that doesn't need to be a crime. So that was something we heard from them a lot. And the bottom line testimony from all of them was basically that actually, when the founders were thinking about what an impeachable offense would be, what Trump did is very similar to what they seem to have in mind, at least according to these scholars' interpretation of the historical record, that the founders were really concerned about foreign influence in our elections, and that was actually part of a lot of the original debates over impeachment.
Yeah. Claire, what did you absorb from what the witnesses called by the Democrats had to say?
Yeah, I think Amelia brings up a really good point, which is I was struck by how much the Democratic witnesses kind of called back to the anxieties of a young United States, a small country without a lot of power, and the sort of specter of foreign influence, you know, the fact that John Adams didn't even want a president figure because he worried about the ways that person could be swung. He didn't want a king kind of figure, and he didn't want a single individual to be influenced. So it was kind of this this history lesson for the country in many ways. And you know, I've read some pieces over the past couple of months that try to do a similar thing, but it was just interesting to see it all kind of spilled out before us in lecture form. Is really kind of going to, it was almost like, I guess you could say, an originalist argument. It wasn't really, but it's the idea that let's go back to what the founders were thinking about when they were talking about high crimes and misdemeanors and abuse of power, right? And that they left the definition purposely vague because they were smart enough to know that they didn't know what would constitute a crime in the decades to come. And I think someone brought up, how could the founders have imagined, you know, the events that led to Watergate, right? You know, that specific kind of thing. So I thought that was an interesting.
I think the quote was, they didn't have wires, so they couldn't have imagined wiretapping.
Yeah, exactly.
One more thing that stood out to me was that they sort of addressed this issue of, oh, you know, an election is coming up. Why don't we just let the voters decide? By saying basically that the founders sort of intended impeachment to be a remedy that happened before an election because the president was sort of posing a danger to the country that was so urgent that he needed to be removed before an election. And that was a theme throughout their testimony as well that stood out to me, that they were sort of trying to emphasize that this is really a threat to our democracy. And it's one that, if it isn't checked in some way, that could actually continue, sort of that Trump might take not being impeached as a sign that what he's doing is okay, or he can get away with it and continue. And so that was another theme in their testimony that really stood out for me.
And so just to clarify who these legal experts are, the Democrats called Noah Feldman, Michael Gerhardt, and Pamela Karlan, and then the Republicans called Jonathan Turley. So that was what we heard from those three witnesses called by the Democrats. What did we hear from Jonathan Turley, who was called by Republicans?
Turley was not really excusing Trump's behavior. He said at one point in his opening statement that Trump mentioning Biden on the infamous July 25th call with Ukraine's president was inappropriate, that he shouldn't have done it. But he was essentially saying, look, the Democrats have moved really fast. They focused only on this Ukraine stuff. They haven't tried to go to court to enforce their subpoenas to various members of the Trump administration who could shed light on what was going on, you know, people like Mick Mulvaney and John Bolton, and that essentially the case is too thin right now, that without this sort of direct proof that Trump connected these investigations and the military aid, there isn't enough evidence for impeachment. And the Democrats should really have done a more thorough investigation. They should have sort of knuckled down, gone into the courts, tried to get that additional testimony. And that right now, the case is just not solid enough to support impeaching a president.
Which is actually kind of an interesting thing to bring up. I mean, obviously, the reason why the Democrats have not pursued court cases with Mick Mulvaney and, let's say, with John Bolton is because they don't necessarily want to drag out the process. They don't want to get into a court battle over, you know, how expansive is executive privilege, because I think the general, you know, the conventional wisdom is they want to have this wrapped up pre-primaries, which is February, basically. So they are kind of looking to go quickly. And there are more witnesses that they could potentially pursue and sort of get more information out of them. And what Turley was saying basically is, do we want to set this precedent? He was saying, this is too narrow a scope. The evidence is too thin. Do we want to set this kind of historical precedent for an impeachment that is super partisan, which, you know, I think all of them are on some level, right? So that's a kind of a hole in that argument. But I wrote this a little on the live blog. I do think there is this general sense among people who study the courts or sit on the courts or argue before the courts, the federal courts, that is, that there is a lot of change happening in politics, partisan politics in America right now. You know, even from 4 years ago, we now talk about, you know, packing the Supreme Court as a potential possibility in parts of the Democratic Party. And I think there is a sort of, that is a compelling argument that you could make to a broader slice of the public of like, whoa, you know, it won't always be, you know, a Democratic Congress going after a Republican president, right? It's the other way around, as it was for Clinton. Do we really want to set this super partisan precedent? So that was kind of like the GOP's witness line, which I think is an interesting one from an intellectual broader point of view, whether or not it kind of stands up to the state of partisanship throughout the decades in America and in American impeachment processes is perhaps a little shakier. But that was kind of what Turley was going for.
Yeah, Turley talked a lot about partisanship, and that was echoing the way that Doug Collins, the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, opened the hearing by saying this is hyperpartisan, this process is flawed, this is a sham. As far as process is concerned, Amelia, this is an impeachment hearing. Usually we think of the Judiciary Committee being in charge of impeachment. This is the first time we're actually seeing a hearing in the Judiciary Committee, and it's probably the last time too. Is the process actually weird here? Is there a real legitimate criticism of that?
Well, the process has been different than the past two impeachments because there wasn't a special counsel involved. So the reason that sort of the process kind of started in Judiciary with Nixon and Clinton was because there was already this investigation that had been going on, you know, in both cases for at least 6 months into the president's misconduct. And some of that evidence, or in the case of Clinton, the whole final special counsel report was available and sort of served as like the base of evidence that was being used as the Judiciary Committee weighed this question of, is this behavior impeachable and what should the articles of impeachment be? And so the way that it's played out in this process is that the Democrats were kind of having to do their own investigation. And so that's what happened in the House Intelligence Committee, first with the closed door depositions, and then with the open hearings. And then finally, yesterday, the report from the House Intelligence Committee became public. And so all of that, I think you can think of as kind of akin to what was happening with the special prosecutors, the sort of gathering of evidence and trying to lay out the facts. The difference is that in this case, the Democrats were doing it. And so I guess, you know, yes, it is different that this is only just now moving to judiciary. I don't know if I would say it's like a really legitimate process critique, because the House kind of gets to set their own rules when it comes to impeachment. And it's worth, you know, remembering that during the Clinton impeachment, there were only four hearings held over the course of 2 days. So, you know, it's not like with the Clinton impeachment, there was this super long, super thorough investigation that happened in the House either.
Yeah, of course, the person who opened this committee was Jerry Nadler, who is the chairman and a Democrat. Claire, what kind of arguments did he present from the start?
I mean, I think it's kind of the Democratic arguments that you've sort of seen a through line with them from perhaps Pelosi's opening press conference through, you know, Adam Schiff and intelligence. It's basically the facts are clear here. I believe the Democratic counsel, when he did questions, he basically, one of the first questions he asked the lawyers was, what is abuse of power, right? And why is it an impeachable offense? So some of this is hammering home the idea that it doesn't have to be that the president committed a crime, although potentially you could argue that he did. It's that he abused his office, right? It's that he used his singular position of power in order to enact personal gain, not gain for the United States of America, the capacity that he's supposed to be acting in. And so I kind of think that that's been the, I think, the strength of the Democratic argument over the, I guess, the past 3 months, right, is that the facts are pretty much on their side. I mean, you know, the GOP ranking member, Collins, kept on saying, no one can agree on the facts. And I think Amelia pointed this out on the live blog, you know, people kind of do agree on the facts with the exception of essentially Fox News viewers. Fox is a network that's pushing a very different, or basically giving credence to the conspiracy theory that Ukraine interfered in our election. Russia did. So I think that was basically what Nadler was doing. And I will say that there was some, a little bit of trepidation pre today's hearing from certain Democrats, maybe worrying about the tone that Nadler would take, the tone that the general committee would take. I think they kind of wanted things today to be pretty serious seeming, sounding, for whatever that's worth.
And we've heard reporting before that Democratic leadership was skeptical of putting Nadler in charge of the impeachment proceedings because he's seen as a more partisan figure and has been saying that for all intents and purposes that his committee has been conducting an impeachment inquiry for much longer than when this Ukraine scandal broke.
Right.
And in terms of, Claire, you mentioned they wanted to make this seem very serious, somber. One of the things that you heard the legal experts talk about is basically, you know, called by the Democrats, no less is at stake here than do we live in a democracy or do we live in a dictatorship or a monarchy? Was that like an effective line of argumentation? Was that overly dramatic? Or is that literally the intent of this impeachment clause that the founders wrote?
Well, I mean, I think the idea behind having an impeachment clause is certainly that you want to be able to remove the president if the president is endangering the nation. So, you know, I think that language like does sound quite dramatic. Impeaching a president is an incredibly dramatic move. So, you know, I don't think that the law professors who were talking about that were really going out on a limb. And obviously they're experts in this. And they really, I think they seemed to communicate pretty well the gravity of what they were talking about.
We've talked before about criticism for looking at these hearings through the lens of theater criticism. But of course, you put for legal experts in front of network cameras, and you have to question, like, how does that read for a broader American audience? What was your takeaway in terms of just how successfully they were able to communicate what would usually be communicated in the classrooms of, you know, in their cases, Stanford or Harvard or GW or UNC?
Well, I would say that in some ways, they each had a different style. I think Pamela Karlan was the most spirited in her testimony. She said in kind of her opening foray, she basically said, I take umbrage with what the ranking member said about me. I think it was, distorting facts or something like that. So she certainly came across as a lively, vigorous advocate for her case that the president had committed impeachable offenses. I think the other two Democratic witnesses, the two men, were a little more flat in their affect. I mean, no shots, you guys. But they were more it felt a little more like a law school lecture, which was interesting. She felt a little bit more like the intelligence hearing witnesses, or certain intelligence hearing witnesses, where it was a little bit more
the Fiona Hill of the judiciary hearings.
Yes.
That kind of makes sense, because she, of those professors, she's a very experienced litigator. She just argued a big case before the Supreme Court back in October about whether sexual orientation is covered under federal employment discrimination law. So this sort of sparring and back and forth, that's something that she's very good at. And she's very well known in liberal circles for being a very good litigator. So I think, there was a little bit of discussion on the live blog about whether this was a good idea,
right,
whether you wanted to have someone who was engaging so much with the Republicans, or if you wanted someone who was a little bit more sedate and professorial and kind of just the facts, and I'm going to lay them out in, a less spirited way, even though the substance of what I'm saying is quite serious and quite dramatic. And I think overall, as I was watching, my impression was that I thought it was actually a good move for them to bring her in, because she did explain things very clearly and very forcefully. And these witnesses were going to probably come across as partisan no matter what, no matter who they were, simply because they were called by the Democrats. So in the end, I thought sort of having someone who was such an effective communicator was a good move for the Democrats.
And as far as the Republican witness goes, he was kind of representing something that we've actually seen in the polling is a decent chunk of Republicans, or even the country in general, people who might say that the president did something wrong, but that this doesn't necessarily amount to an impeachable offense. So that was not a strongly partisan, the president did absolutely nothing wrong. Is it just because they couldn't find a legal expert who was willing to go down that path? Or was this a strategic move saying, we want to speak to that segment of the American public who may be convinced that President Trump did something unethical but don't think he should be removed for it?
I don't actually know the provenance of exactly who decided, Turley would be the best person, but I think that he is a highly respected legal scholar who, while he doesn't toe the GOP line exactly on impeachment, right, but he is still a vigorous legal defender. So in some ways, the fact that he might disagree about, frankly, with Trump on certain things, or Trump's actions in this specific Ukraine situation, he still, in general, is giving a pretty full-throated argument against the impeachment inquiry. So it perhaps doesn't matter all that much if he disputes, certain little details of it.
Right. And I mean, so Turley also, he testified during the Clinton impeachment. So that might have been one reason why they wanted to call him back. He sort of has credibility as an expert. And he also kind of went to great pains to say, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm upset about what's happening. I didn't like what Trump did.
Well, he opened by saying that he voted against Trump in the election.
Right. Right. And so, you know, I mean, I think Republicans could have found someone if they wanted to come out and say, you know, Trump did nothing wrong. It was a perfect phone call, you know, whatever. But I think they do appear to have made a strategic choice to have chosen someone who is not going to say, you know, what Trump did was good, but would say, look, the Democrats' case is just not powerful enough. And I think, you know, I think it was Perry on the live blog noted that the exchange with Turley during the Republicans' questioning was just much more substantive than a lot of the sort of Republican questioning that we've seen so far. They were kind of engaging like a real legal argument rather than just sort of saying, why isn't the whistleblower here? Or we should call Adam Schiff. For you.
Where is Alexandra Chalupa?
Right, exactly. Like sort of trying to like confuse and muddle and throw sand in the gears. And so, you know, and I think you can disagree with what Turley was saying and the argument that the Republicans were putting forward, but it was a substantive argument. And that's clearly the choice they made here.
So wrapping up, what comes next in this impeachment inquiry?
The Democrats have to start deciding on articles of impeachment. And I think they've sort of left it open that there might be more hearings. But, you know, if they want to vote on articles of impeachment before Christmas, they don't have a whole lot of time. And I think one thing that I'll be watching for as this process goes forward is the Mueller report actually came up a couple of times during the testimony. And it seems like there's sort of some tension within the Democratic caucus right now about whether they want to sort of, you know, hew very closely to the Ukraine scandal in the articles of impeachment, or if they want to think about bringing in something like, you know, the obstruction of justice claims that came out of the Mueller report and have that be part of an article of impeachment or its own article of impeachment. So I think that's one of the things that's going to be getting worked out over the next couple of weeks.
All right. Well, we will stay tuned. But that's it for today. So thanks a lot, Amelia.
Of course.
And thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
For the rest of today's podcast, we're going to take a deeper look at how public opinion has changed or not since these impeachment hearings began. As we've mentioned before, 538 has joined with Ipsos to conduct a panel poll asking some of the same people about their thoughts every 2 weeks throughout this impeachment process. And we just got our second round of results, so we're going to dig into them. And here with me to do that, our 538's quantitative editor, Laura Bronner. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thanks for being with us. And also with us is the president of U.S. Public Affairs at Ipsos, Clifford Young. Thank you for being with us, Cliff.
It's awesome to be here. Thank you.
Let's start off with the top line results. What has stayed steady? What has changed since the beginning of this process?
The main thing is that the top line results have largely stayed steady. About 57% of people think that President Trump has committed an impeachable offense. That's essentially the same percentage as last time. So on the top line, not that much has changed.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of stability, and whether it be this poll or other polls, sort of over the course of the inquiry thus far, there's a lot of stability with the ballot question.
Underneath all of that, we're asking a lot of questions as part of this panel poll to get more information than just that top line result. So, Laura, what are some of the more interesting trends that we've seen in terms of what has changed?
Well, one really interesting thing is that the number of people that say that Trump withheld military aid from Ukraine unless they agreed to an investigation into the Bidens has actually increased from about 56% to about 63% overall. So since the hearings over the last 2 weeks were sort of focused around that question, with the hearing of Gordon Sondland focusing on that quid pro quo element, I do think that's significant.
What does this mean, Cliff, that we're seeing the top line numbers stay the same in terms of whether or not people think Trump committed an impeachable offense? But when it comes to the facts of the case, people's views have evolved.
Yeah, well, of course, we don't know. We typically, when we're looking at things, these things over time, these could be potential leading indicators of where public opinion will go. And so while, once again, we don't have movement on the primary ballot question when it comes to impeachment, we are seeing that public opinion is paying attention, is learning. Now, whether that translates into change attitudes towards the ultimate ballot question, that's another question, obviously, and that's something we might see in our third wave. But right now, we're seeing public opinion learning and processing new information as it comes out.
Were there any other, Cliff, interesting trends that you took note of in looking at the results?
Yeah, I think it's very, very interesting. I think that, you know, when it comes to impeachment, the word impeachment, you know, it means a lot of things to a lot of people, and there's nuance to it. And I thought one of the key distinctions in this poll was the difference between whether the American public believed that Trump committed an impeachable offense. Once again, we cited the 57% number, not much change from the last wave. However, when we push people, and this is a new question on this wave, when we push people and we ask them, you know, at the end of the impeachment process, what do you think should happen to President Trump? Should he be impeached by the House and removed from office, or should voters decide? We see a 47-51 split. In other words, only 47% of Americans are in favor of his impeachment and removal. So 57% think maybe he committed an impeachable offense, but only 47% believe he should be removed. I think we should always understand that there's nuance to the term, to the concept of impeachment, and public opinion reflects this.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the most interesting things we found. So 12% of people overall did think he committed an impeachable offense, but at the same time wanted to let voters decide on his fate rather than have Congress impeach and remove him. Also, the fact that that's actually higher among Democrats, where it's 17%, whereas among Republicans, it's only 7%.
So, okay, there's a group of people here who say, yes, I think President Trump committed an impeachable offense, but I don't think he should be impeached and removed. That's an interesting dynamic. Is that different from last time? What can we take away from that 12% number?
Yeah, I mean, so we added the question compared to last time, so we don't have the comparison. I do think we should, you know, we will keep it in, so we will be able to track that, whether that group grows or shrinks going forward. I do think that it's an interesting thing, because that sort of explains the discrepancy between the top line finding that we had last time of like 56-57% of people who do think he committed this impeachable offense. But as we show in our impeachment tracker, there's not a majority supporting impeachment and removal. So I think this basically explains the gap.
The key takeaway for me ultimately is when we have all these polls out there in the market, we have to be very careful about how they're worded, because you can get big swings. 10% is a big deal from a political perspective. Being over 50% means something much different than being below 50%. So a very telling, interesting finding. And obviously looking forward, repeating these questions over time, we'll be able to understand the specific subgroups and how they're migrating one way or the other.
As Laura mentioned, this 12% of people who think the president committed an impeachable offense don't think he should be removed. More of them are Democrats, actually, than Republicans. So is that a positive sign for Democrats who look to convince the American public that the president should be impeached and removed? Or are these Democrats who are pretty hardened in their view that maybe he did something wrong, but it should be up to the voters?
Yeah, I would say that's a potential target. It's not very large, we have to keep in mind. And ultimately, unless some material facts change, or we see these sort of familiarity and understanding numbers significantly change, not just by 7 or 8%, but something more significant, there's not much upside right this second for Democrats. In some ways, they do have potential with the Democratic subgroup, but it doesn't represent a big chunk of the American population.
And that gets to the question of just how hardened people are in their views at this point. Did we see any movement in how strongly people believe what they believe between the first and second wave before and after these hearings?
Overall, about 20% of people became less certain of their views, while 16% of people became more certain, and about 65% of people stayed the same in terms of their certainty.
Wait, that's interesting.
Brand new result. I haven't shared it before.
Turkey.
Turkey just
Turkey,
what?
Probably. Yeah,
people
Thanksgiving.
Ate too much turkey. Got confused.
Maybe got tired, sleepy. No, but I think it was the break in the hearings. That's at least our interpretation. There could be other ones. I think people sort of, you know, it's been in the media constantly, but once you take it away, you have this sort of a media effect, and people start focusing on other things, turkey and I guess NFL football and sports and family and those sorts of things. We'll see where we're at in the next week, obviously. I would also say that where we do see shifts, once again, in the questions about whether certain things happened, the quid pro quo, for instance, we do see a heightened partisanship. So on those things that happen that are, let's say, more Democratic leaning or more in their favor, we see Democrats becoming more hardened in their view. And when it comes to Republicans, like issues that are more leaning on their side, for instance, did it happen Joe Biden behaved unethically towards Ukraine while he was vice president? The changes from 43 to 48, I mean, it's right within, you know, the margin of error. We have to be very, it's right at the edge. We have to be careful there. But there is some perceptible shift. Those tend to be more Republicans. So what we're seeing is maybe the top line numbers shifting slightly, but in the belief of what happened, there's increased partisanship when you peel away the onion and look at where people are going.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is we asked people whether the hearings have made them more or less likely to believe that Trump committed an impeachable offense. And 38% of people said more likely. But among those, 95% of people already thought he had committed an impeachable offense in the last wave. So people are saying that they're changing their mind, but the people that are saying they're changing their mind are actually already in that position. The same thing is true for people that said they became less likely to think so. 95% of those people already said he had not committed an impeachable offense.
Right. So it's like, I have changed my mind, and the way that I changed my mind is that I believe even more the thing that I previously believed.
Totally.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting.
It's just, yeah, just like in this highly, highly tribal, polarized time, the cleavages we see here, the distinctions we see here are replicated in many other public opinion domains. And so it's not surprising that people are just becoming more hardened in their already pre-existing views. It's just related to impeachment and not, let's say, to immigration, healthcare, or some other gun control or some other issue.
Cliff, you mentioned where public opinion falls on some of the facts of the case. Did Biden do something wrong? Did Trump do something wrong? One of the main counterarguments that we've heard from Republicans over the past few weeks is an inaccurate theory that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election and that that's why Trump wanted to investigate. We asked people whether or not they believed this. Do they?
Overall, only about 30% of Americans believe that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election, compared to 71% who believe that Russia did correctly. But the interesting thing here is that there actually isn't a partisan divide. So among both Democrats and Republicans, only about 30% believe that Ukraine interfered. So far, at least, it doesn't appear that this talking point has landed that much, even among Republicans.
I think that talking point is much more of a talking point to resonate at the elite level, the decision maker level. It's sort of a talking point that potentially gives cover to Republican, politicians, senators, and House members, and other sort of operatives, rather than necessarily believing it's going to resonate more generally with public opinion. That'd be my interpretation. And to Laura's point, obviously, only a third of people, or 30% or so, believe that.
And we ask people about their media diet. So beyond just partisanship, we get a sense of where people are getting their news from. What were we able to determine according to news sources?
Yeah, so this is another advantage of the panel, is that actually we asked about media diet in the first wave, and so we'll be able to check what effect that has going forward. And among Fox News viewers, about 44% of people believe in the Ukraine interference theory. That's higher than among viewers of any other news network. And also, not coincidentally, Fox News viewers also have the lowest percentage of believing that Russia interfered in the 2016 election.
Though 44% for me still is interesting and fascinating. So it's still a claim that less than even a majority of Fox viewers actually believe. And so, again, I just think it's something that resonates at the elite decision maker level and not necessarily with public opinion in general.
Laura brought up how this is an advantage of this kind of panel poll, where since you ask from the beginning what people's media diet is, you can see how their views change according to which channels or sources they get their news from. Cliff, I'm interested in general, what are some of the other advantages of using a panel poll like the one that we do?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, obviously, it's analytical. And so the ability to track individuals over time, you know, we can call them switchers even, so, or migrators. And indeed, when we have a few more waves in, we'll start doing analysis like that. It becomes very rich. You can profile these sorts of, let's say, soft supporters and strong supporters by their attitudinal and behavioral profiles over time. The other big advantage is there's less variability. to a panel design that is, you know, this is different than what's typically done. A typical poll is, it's called a cross section. So what we do is we take a representative sample of the American population in wave one. In wave two, we'll take another random sample, but not of the same people. This is of the same people. And that design's interesting because it reduces the margin of error a bit. We have less sampling variability, so we're able to detect, you know, smaller changes. So typically when we're seeing a 3 to 4 point change in a typical poll, we would say, yeah, we're not quite sure. It's all within the margin of error. With this sort of platform or instrument, we're able to at least draw qualitative inferences that way. And so that's a huge advantage. And the third one is, because we're tracking these people over time, we have a lot of profile data. So we have a lot of information on their consumption patterns, their voting behavior, their attitudes towards other issues, which is great when we want to really understand who they are. So those are the three big advantages to such a poll and design.
One thing to note here is that this is an online poll, and regular listeners to this podcast know that we've talked about some of the challenges that online pollsters face, and that different polling firms are trying different things in order to get as accurate results as they can through online polling. How does Ipsos mitigate some of those challenges of getting a representative sample online?
Yeah, so that's the biggest challenge of doing online polls, is that often you have holes in your, in what we call sample frame, in your overall sample. So often we underrepresent minorities and rural voters, which by the way are two very important segments when it comes to American elections. This design is different than your typical online design where you're sort of recruiting people off of websites via river sampling and other sort of related methods. What we actually do is we go offline first and we recruit people. So we actually use a design called address-based sampling. So it's the U.S. postal code of all the addresses. And we select a random sample. By the way, this sample that we're doing for 538 is approximately 2,000 individuals. We have an entire panel sample of approximately 60,000 interviews, which we drew it from. But those 60,000 individuals were actually recruited offline. So we basically selected a sample using the postal code, having the address, and we send multiple communications via snail mail, which is, by the way, one of the most effective ways of accessing the entire population, because everyone gets it, both those that are online and offline. We actually have follow-up using telephone as well. And what's great about that design is we are able to capture a lot of the subgroups that, you know, we would miss using more traditional online methods or even telephone. That is minority voters, voters in rural areas, and other smaller populations. So overall, it is an online poll, but the way we went about selecting the sample and recruiting our respondents is much different, much more analogous to, you know, your traditional gold standard approaches.
That's really interesting. So we're going to continue with this panel poll throughout the impeachment process. We'll have more news for listeners as we get more results. Laura, are there any other data points that you're going to be watching for as we continue to do these panel polls every 2 weeks?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm really fascinated to see how people think about whether these statements actually happened.
I absolutely agree. I think the facts of the case, those are the, I would say, the key components of trying to understand the impeachment process writ large. And to what extent do Americans change their opinions towards these facts? I mean, we've seen small but detectable differences thus far. We would typically think that as people increasingly believe certain facts are true, that would change their ultimate attitudes and behaviors towards impeachment. We haven't seen that, and we don't know if we're going to see that. You might have a huge chunk of the population, mostly Republican, that agree that the facts exist, that there was perhaps, for instance, a quid pro quo. It was clear, but that it doesn't warrant Trump's removal. I think understanding how these facts evolve and how voters differentially process them and come to their ultimate decisions will be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And just out of personal curiosity, right, we're asking people about whether things that we know through evidence and reporting are true or are not true. Is this normal course for polling? Are there other kinds of polling experiments that you do at Ipsos where you're just frankly asking people about things that we already know the answer to just to see if they believe in facts?
Yeah, I mean, it's an increasing activity that we engage in, especially in the era of fake news, you know, looking at whether people agree with certain facts and to what extent they actually affect their specific sort of attitudes and behaviors towards given ballots. I mean, so I would say we've always done it to some extent, and I'll give you an example, a clear example in a second, but we're increasingly doing it in this age of fake news. And what we find is facts don't always impact ultimate attitudes and predispositions towards outcomes. Now, where it was very interesting, where we kind of, it was less about facts and more about details, the whole notion of support for ACA or Obamacare. And so we knew that in general, in abstract, only 50% of the American population supported it, maybe a little bit less. But when we took item by item of the bill, a vast majority of Americans across partisan lines supported it, except for the individual mandates. But our point being is that there is this distinction between facts and ultimately your predisposition towards a given outcome, or the specifics of a bill or an activity versus the general support. And the difference is politics and sort of tribalism and what sort of color you're wearing, red or blue. That's at least our experience in it.
Yeah, in the facts that we asked people about in this poll, it was interesting because we asked whether Trump asked the government of Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. And there was a relatively high percentage, even among Republicans, who said that they thought that was true, but much fewer thought that it was inappropriate or even impeachable. Whereas for the statements of whether President Trump withheld military aid from Ukraine, conditioned that on the investigation, and the question of whether he and his administration attempted to cover up their actions on Ukraine, only about a quarter of Republicans thought that that happened, even as much more of them thought that if it happened, it would be inappropriate.
I think that this case is a very interesting telling case about how humans process information. And so we often think that humans are very deductive. They'll take the facts, they'll add them up, and they'll come to a decision. But for the most part, humans don't think like that. They're inverted. They reasoned as motivated thinkers and say they know their position, they work backwards. Damn the facts. Let the facts, whatever the facts might be,
yeah.
They like or they hate Trump, for instance. And I think that, you know, we'll see what happens, but I think that this poll is capturing that sort of cognitive processing and how humans really come to their ultimate decisions.
Well, this is all really fascinating. So thank you so much to both of you for taking the time. And I look forward to seeing the results that we get as we move forward in the process. So thank you, Laura.
Thanks. Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Clifford.
Thanks, Galen. It was great.
Clifford Young is the president of U.S. Public Affairs at Ipsos. You can dig more into the data for yourself on our website at 538.com, where we have those results. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store. Or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.